Begin. We have an interesting affair. Yesterday's shiur was heavyweight. As far as the material, today already it's a little lighter, but fascinating. Today is Monday, February 26th, 2018, and here we are in Yerushalayim. A little rain, a little clouds, and I hope a little sun later today. First of all, in relation to yesterday's shiur, I just want to repeat again that I confused two different basic Sion Levis. And I once again want to thank my Talmud, Josh Schneider, who surfs the internet and came up with the documents. And the Taka was a Sfadik Levi, a Sfadik Sion Rachamim at YU. And the Taka was a Sion Rachamim Levi from Yerushalayim, who later winds up in Panama, Zelichud v'Zelichud. But they both studied and were growing up at the same time. I also want to mention on page 26 of one of the freebies, the Tarragon family is being publicized. It seems Harav Eli Tarragon is now directing Machon Halacha V'Horah Shel Rav Rimon. It's going to be called Sulamot, and the director is Eli Tarragon. How does Eli Tarragon relate to you?
He's my cousin's son.
Cousin's son, unbelievable. I also want to mention that I'm in good company. This is an interview with Reb Heschel Schechter in Jewish Press, I believe. And I have to say, they asked him about the pictures of women, and he too agrees with me that it's a desecration that they're not showing pictures of women. It's unbelievable. We shout and we yell and we cry from today to tomorrow, and I'm sure people are listening. I know that there are big shots in Agudat Yisrael who are listening to my shayurim, but everyone's looking over their shoulder. And speaking about looking over their shoulder, I understood my Rebbe even more yesterday. I was driving home after shir, after all that beautiful morning, and all of Yeshivat Chevron was emptying out. Hundreds and hundreds of bachurim walking towards Shaarei Chesed to the funeral. Everyone was dressed exactly the same. A black suit and a black hat. And the only difference between them that I could tell, some were tall and some were short. And boy, did I recall my Rebbe's words at the Holes of Sheva Brachas. All day long today is to show I'm no different from my neighbor. I think like you, I act like you, I dress like you, I eat like you. And this is not conducive to creating Gedolei Yisrael. It's the wrong word by word. But the literature world, Yosef, we have lost out. And one day you will say, I yet knew a dinosaur named Aaron Rakefet. With that being said, we're now in the golden period of Agudas Rabbanim. What I said last week was very true. See, Reb Lazer Silva, he came from Europe. I can't say he became a total American, but he came from Europe. He was not a finished product. He was an Eloi, but he was not a Gadol. And his learning, I heard this from many who knew him, he became a Gadol in America. Sat and learned, finished his business with the Kehillah in Harrisburg, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, went to the shul and sat there until 12 midnight. And you should know that there was a president in Harrisburg, this is one of the reasons he finally left, I write about it, that gave him an argument. He's using the shul's electricity to learn late into the night. You understand? This is the mentality. And he knew America. There were more like him, but he is the prime example. Rav Leventhal, they say, everyone describes him. If you look up his biography, look up the Encyclopedia Judaica, you'll see everyone calls him the most Americanized of the European Rabbanim. He too, he mastered the American scene. See, it's slightly a new generation. Ramaz, Kilat Jeshurun, Joseph Lookstein, his grandson-in-law. Something is happening. And this is the golden period between the interbellum period from World War I to World War II is the golden era of the Agudas HaRabbanim. I mean, it's hard today, you know, when you talk about the Agudas HaRabbanim, everyone looks at you and figures, it's a dead organization. It has no influence. It's fighting over the property that's on the Lower East Side, which is worth a fortune today. But there was a lot more to the Agudas HaRabbanim during the interbellum period. This was the golden period. Now, the World War I, as I said last week, and this becomes crucially important, we'll come back to it, it puts Eretz Yisrael on the map. It puts Zionism on the map. Before World War I, if you became a Zionist, particularly in the Western world, in Europe there were more Zionists. You see, it's interesting too, the Haskalah, everyone curses the Haskalah. Everyone maledicts the Haskalah. But you have to differentiate. The Haskalah in Western Europe led to total assimilation. You all know that out of Mendelssohn's descendants, only one grandson died Jewish. One grandson. Great-grandchildren, I don't believe there was one who was Jewish. And there's the famous story when Germany, when Ben-Gurion established the relationships with Germany, which was a tremendous battle. The Rav was opposed. We have the Rav on tape screaming, yelling. He sounded more right-wing than Menachem Begin at the time. Although they say later in life the Rav said maybe I was wrong because people told the Rav that the German reparations money built the state of Israel. There's a lot of truth to it. When I came in Aliyah, I remember people telling me the same thing, that until the reparations this was a very poor country. And gradually it lifted itself. So when the first delegation came, the educational consul, whatever they call him, the attaché to the German delegation, was a fellow named Henzel. And Kressel was the Israeli equivalent. He was a librarian, a lexicographer, a man who had a world of knowledge. And he speaks with Henzel, and he looks at him, and he says, your name is Henzel. And he says to him, are you a direct descendant? And Henzel knew immediately what he was saying. He said, yes, my great-great-great-great-grandfather was Moshe Mendelssohn. And you see there, and here you take Moshe Mendelssohn, who I know they never taught you this in Beit Yaakov or in Finchas Mayim. Moshe Mendelssohn was named after the Ramban, his great-grandfather. Moshe Rissalis was his great-grandfather. Moshe Mendelssohn was a Shomer Torah mitzvah. That's no question about it. We have anecdotal evidence. We have biographical evidence. I mean, there's no question. But his kids, his grandchildren, and all was lost. It's like I said yesterday. I think I said it in class. I said it. Did I say it Friday night or Saturday night? Whatever. I said it at one point over the weekend. Reb Meir Yaakov Soloveitchik, big lectures that Hamilton is Jewish. So I said, Hamilton may or may not be Jewish, but to me I have a different question. Who's around if he was Jewish? His direct descendants, that's what counts. Elvis Presley was Jewish too, you know that. Elvis Presley always boasted he was a Shabbos guy. So it turned out Hitaka lived in a two-family house with the Rav of New Orleans, and they were very close. They loved Elvis. He was a kid, he was the Shabbos guy. Go and dream, they found on Elvis's grandmother's grave, his mother's mother, a Magen David, she was Jewish. Now, if the grandmother, Mitzat, the matriarch, was Jewish, so Elvis Presley was Jewish. Now, Vasquez, the son of London, who's around Elvis Presley today in the Jewish world? So the Haskalah in Western Europe became a lot more positive. It led ultimately to the revival of Hebrew. It led ultimately to Zionism. It led to Chochmat Yisrael in a much more positive form. I can give you a simple example, the Digdekei Sofrim. Digdekei Sofrim was a Talmud Chaver of Yitzchok Chanan Spekta. Everyone looked up to him. What he did on Shas, it's nothing equals it as far as coming up with the correct reading. No, he was a Jew with a long beard and payas. There was no question about his frumkeit. You follow? It led to a much... It wasn't like Tzuntz, who were kept, I have to say, in later life he came back, but Sir Leopold Zuntz, who's accredited with being the founder of Wissenschaft des Judentum in Germany, his home was Treif. And then, later in life, he kashered his home, and some of his friends made fun of him. Herr Dr. Zuntz? Foolish thing like Kashrut, you understand? They couldn't tolerate it. You didn't find that in Eastern Europe. Yes, sister.
And yet the Rav felt that it's impossible to know Siddur without studying Zuntz.
You know, Zuntz, there's a lot that I can tell you better. The whole concept of homiletics, the Shieltot. I give you a simple example where we're indebted to Zuntz. How many of you have studied the Shieltot? And what does the word shiltut mean? Questions. Aramaic word for questions. Why do you have questions? Why do all the drushes basically begin with questions? And he clued us in. The shiltut really began as during the Goyni period of Shabbos, people worked all week. They had no time to learn. Their children are going among this. So their time to learn was Shabbos. No, I want to ask you, Nach the Chalant on Shabbos, you're going to hear a long drasha, you're going to fall asleep. So if you begin with a question, you keep them awake. I used to pull the shtick in BMT when I had, you know, these kids, and it was late in the afternoon, so I could begin a class by asking, tell me, gentlemen, I want to ask you a simple question. Saturday night, you're down at Richie's. Anyone remember Richie's? It was the first pizza parlor in Israel. It's historic today. No one can believe it. Americans opened it. It's the 70s, early 70s, and everyone went to Richie's Saturday night. It was a shame dubba, right at the heart of Yafo and King George. So Machon Gold girls were there, BMT boys were there. So I say, tell me, fellas, you say a good Devar Torah to your girlfriend from Machon Gold, and she wants to give you a Yashikayat Shabbos. Are you allowed to take her hand? And I say, maybe I'll answer it later. And I get, you know, then I gave the whole lecture. Then an hour later, a kid pops up. Rebbe, what's the answer? Well, what question you thought? Oh, that question? What's the shaila? Of course you can't take our hand. What are you, an apikiris? So, but Zuntz developed his classic work is the history of Sermanics among the Jews. And you got to give him credit. The man knew the Rishonim, he knew the Goyim, the Rishonim, the Gemara. Yeah, after all, Tosfos calls the Shieltot too. He was a Lamdan Mufak, and he came back. You see, it was much more positive. It never reached Geiger in Germany, called for the abolition of Brit Milah. All these morons today that call for the abolition of Brit Milah, the Abrahamic ritual, the Abrahamic covenant, they call it. You didn't have that in Eastern Europe. You see, that was the difference. And Zionism, this was the golden period. Zionism went on the map. Even in the Western world, people recognized we must have an Eretz Yisrael, we must have a home for the Jews, we have to get away from the pogroms. Now, Central Relief Committee and joining with the JDC, so I want to make a slight emendation and a slight correction. I spoke about Aaron Teitelbaum, Rav Aaron Teitelbaum. So his grandson, Taka, opened Eye World, but my Talmud reminded me, Maskinish Kachat, I remember it well now, he opened it with a partner, Moshe Schechter. So I can't say that Ari Teitelbaum opened it alone, opened with Moshe Schechter. Moshe Schechter, I knew him quite well. Later, he left the eye business, although he's an optometrist. He was caught up in real estate, as I recall. And he did well, and he saw, what do I need the tzara of running an optometry store with ordering glasses and people not satisfied? So Ari bought him out. But I do want to mention they were partners together. I made a mistake. Ohel Aram on Rehov Chalap, I thought was named after Rabbi Aaron Teitelbaum. It's named after Aaron Teitelbaum. It was a different Aaron Teitelbaum. I found that out Saturday night. It was an Aaron Teitelbaum from Chicago, who I think had no children, and he wanted to leave Yad Vashem. And he built that shul. That shul was built for Avraham Crow. Again, the old timers in Jerusalem know what I'm talking about, but I don't know if you were here at the time. Avraham Crow, That was a shul built around the rabbi. Anyone recognize the name Avram Kroll? Avram Kroll was a Gerach Chassid, who, photographic memory, Nukala Torah Kula Baal Peh, every Rashi, every Tosfot, every line. Unfortunately, he went through the Holocaust, and he lived the Holocaust to the day he died. In his presence, you could feel the Holocaust. In Eretz Yisrael, in Belgium, where he survived the war, he had a grocery shop. Could you imagine? And that's why he lived. He did well, a grocery. He came in Aliyah at some point in the 60s, and the Americans, the Anglos, started gathering around him. And they built that shul for him to daven in and to teach Torah. And every Shabbos afternoon, he used to give a drasha, Shalashudis. People came from all around, including the Baron Lichtenstein. And the sight to see, Ashrei Ayin Rat Hazot, Reb Baron sitting right next to Rav Kroll, and both of them, all of Shas and Poskim by heart. It was a sight to see. Wow. So that shul was named Oel Aaron because the Nadvan was Aaron Teitelbaum from Chicago. Okay. Right, in a book. I have it. They did that towards the end of his life. They put together his drasha in a sefer. It was edited by Meir Chovav. I'm telling you, you get me started. My heart warms up. Meir Chovav. Did anyone know Meir Chovav? Meir Chovav, when you read the memoirs of Yeshivat Hebron, he was Meir Freund. He was the Chavrita of Rav Beryl Schwartzman, Rav Dov Schwartzman. Rav Dov later goes to America and runs for Baron Cutler's son-in-law. Rav Meir remained here and he hebritized his name. He became a tremendous chassid of Alon Shvut, of Rav Baron Lichtenstein. You have no idea these people, what they accomplished, their families. Meir Chovav has a daughter, professor. She's the ranking expert in the world on Piyut today. Published fabulous forum. I think she teaches at Hebrew U. Elinor, I believe, is her first name. It's his daughter, Meir Chovav, has a son who's an editor until today, a graduate of the Gush, and edits Sfarim. What families, what people. Now, this is fascinating. How did they raise the money? And you're talking Central Relief. Now, during the war, the JDC is credited with distributing over $5 million. It is estimated that $1.5 million was raised by the Central Relief. That's the from Jews. How did they raise it? So very interesting. The Agudas HaRabbanim called upon every Jew to give 3% of his income to the Central Relief. Well, I don't know how many gave 10%, 3%, interesting 3%, how they arrived at the number, the Sefer Yovel does not say. But what's fascinating, they added 10 cents to every ticket sold for Yom HaNorayim. And you don't recall this, what used to go on, Yom HaNorayim knew, and how did the shuls know you paid for a seat? There wasn't an Erev in New York. You're coming, let's say, Shabbos, Rosh is Yom Kippur. Shabbos is Rosh Hashanah. How do you know you paid for a seat? Do you remember? They used to give out a bindle that you put around your arm. Even that, some wanted, some complained, some said it's not, and others said, no, it's not carrying. You'll find literature on it. But it's like people who wear a bindle from Kever Rachel. You wore a bindle, whatever the color was. One year they used the blue color, one year a red. Otherwise you're going to save it from year to year. So it was very, and there when they charged extra, they charged extra. That was real. That was real. Now, following the end of the war, so you get involved, tremendous Zionist activities. All eyes are on Palestine. Even the Reform Jews, the conservative Jews, Allah kama bakama, the Orthodox Jews, all eyes are on Palestine. Now, what do you have going in Palestine? You have the Yishuv Hayashan. Yishuv Hayashan, the old-time yeshiva, the Eitz Chaim is the most preeminent example. But even in the Yishuv Hayashan now, people are starting to break out, to move beyond. People are moving to Geula, to Me'ez Sharim, to Mishkanot Shananim. Those of you familiar with Yerushalayim, people are moving to Petach Tikva, Kfar Saba. These were some of the early settlements. You go up north, you go further, Binyamin, Zichron Yaakov. And in all these settlements, you had from Jews. There was no Chilul Shabbos. Chilul Shabbos b'Parhesia was unheard of. Yes, in a Shoma Tzir Kibbutz, there was no trace of Shabbos, no trace of Yom Kippur. But in the cities, in the Moshav, there was no Chilul Shabbos whatsoever. You all know Achara Am, Chaim Nachman Bialik, Dizengoff. These people totally opposed to Chilul Shabbos. All right, you'll say Bialik learned in Volozhin. Acharam was married to the sixth Rebbe's first cousin, I believe. Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson's first cousin was married to Acharam. Acharam was a Hasidic Shagon. You don't even start to realize who these people were. Now, Chaim Nachman Bialik, everyone knows, learned in Volozhin and had a good understanding of Yiddishkeit in the Beis Medrash. You read his poetry, Hamatmid. I mean, it's overwhelming. You cry. But Chaim Nachman Bialik was not the London that Acharam was. Asher Ginsberg was a London Muvhak. He was a Shvat Rav. You know the story with him. He wanted to go to gymnasium. He wanted to get an education. He wanted to go to, like, MTA, we'll put it that way. His parents said to him, over our dead body, God forbid. You follow? When his parents died, he left. He was Masadi Gittin in the rabbinate. We'll talk about that next Sunday. What does it mean, Masadi Gittin? You have to know something. His Gittin were accepted by everyone. Then, when his parents died, he went to gymnasium. He becomes an accountant. He became the controller for Vysotsky's tea. You follow? That's Acharam. And then he comes Acharam. The street is named. That's where he lived. And Shabbos, every they closed the whole area down. He shouldn't be disturbed. Every afternoon, I think between 2 to 4, no cars were allowed on the street where Acharam lived. They didn't want to disturb his afternoon nap. It was a small Israel. But that was Acharam. So it was a different. But these people needed money. And the central relief totally centered now on helping Torah institutions after World War I. In Eastern Europe, World War I, we basically, the Jews as a whole never recovered from World War I. You all know what happened afterwards. There was a depression. America was the roaring 20s. There were pogroms against Jews. There was the whole communist takeover. But the yeshiva tried to reestablish themselves. And Eastern Europe was still the heart of Torah learning. And here you had, for the sake of arguments, Slabodka, which had been in exile, comes back to Slabodka. They have to start all over. Tells has to start, has to expand. Mir, I don't have to tell you, was the biggest yeshiva of the time. Panovich, Baruch Be'ez yeshiva, one after another, the yeshiva are trying to reestablish themselves. Kletsk, Rabbi Aaron Kotler, everyone needs funds. And the Agudas HaRabbanim takes the lead with the central relief. It's the same interaction. You're basically dealing with the same people are leading these two organizations. And they come up with this brilliant idea to bring three of the greatest rabbanim in the world to the United States, not to give shiurim, but to raise funds to go all over, everywhere that the Jewish communities, the United States and Canada, to speak, to plead, to raise funds, and they declare a $1 million goal for the 1924 rabbinical visit. This is sponsored by the Center Relief. It's a very important event. You'll see why. Way beyond the fundraising. It has many other implications. Now, who do you choose to come to the United States? So very interestingly, by now all the Eastern European yeshivot realized our brother's keeper is in the United States. The Jews in America, the East Europeans now have a second generation. The second generation is integrated, Americanized, and most important, they are making money. They have money. So the yeshivot in Europe are thinking, we got to send a shaluch there. We have to send someone to America, a shaliach, I should say. It's not Chabad, a shaliach. Let him raise funds. Who can be a shaliach and need another Mgadol? So Slabodki Yeshiva decided to send the Rosh Yeshiva, Reb Moshe Mordechai Epstein, to America, assisted by, as you know from my Hakarat HaTov classes, by Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Cohen Lessin, who was a fundraiser for the Kollel of Slabodka back in Europe and was, you know, very presentable, a good speaker. And you heard my description of him. He was Kulo Omer Gatlet Adam. It was real Slabodka before your eyes. So he comes to America. He's going to be in America anyway. So the Center Relief decides, we're going to bring two other people, and they keep the Levush Mordechai, Reb Moshe Mordechai, they keep him under lock and key. In other words, they're not appearing in public yet. Ah, but who are they going to bring? The most famous name in the world, Reb Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, the Ashkenazic Chief Rabbi of Palestine. Now you got to remember, Reb Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, this is Zionism. All eyes are upon Palestine. Rav Cook is coming to America? Wow! The attention it attracts. And in addition to Rav Cook, they're going to bring, notice how it's dividing up. The Levush Mordechai is the Rebbe of Slabodka, but everybody knows him as the Rosh Yeshiva of Slabodka. Rav Cook represents Palestine, Eretz Yisrael. And they bring probably the most famous Rav of Eastern Europe in the Litvische Welt, the Rav of Kovna, Rav Avram Dovber Kahana Shapiro, the Deva Avraham. Talmud Mufak of Voloshin Yeshiva, a Gon Adir, when the Deva Avraham appeared, the first edition, it just hit the Lumdisha Yeshivisha world. The Kovna Rav was a Gon Adir. A few words about the Kovna Rav. He was very broad-minded. In other words, you're now bringing three great rabbis to America. Certainly Rav Cook was broad-minded to the extent that it created a lot of opposition to him. The Kovna Rav was very broad-minded as well. He was very open, understood the modern world, and the greatest proof that what I'm saying is correct, who gave Moreinu v'Rabbeinu Smicha? The Kovna Rav. In my humble opinion, you know my theory, when the Rav cried and said, the efficacy of prayer, sometimes you have to be thankful to God for not answering your prayer. And he spoke about, there was a shteller I wanted, and I prayed so hard, and had God granted my prayer, and I'm quoting the Rav now, I would not be alive, my wife would not be alive, my children would not be alive. And that shteller, he didn't give the name, but I'm 99% sure, you can't say 100% when you have a theory, it has to be the taking his uncle's place on the Vilna Basin. Rav Menachem Karakovsky had just died, I believe, in 29. The Rav is going steady with a girl from Vilna in 31. He was 30 already. He's getting married in 31. And he needs a shtela. He's going to finish up his doctorate in 32. And he needs a shtela. And Rav Chaim Weiss did not get the shtela. And my educated theory is that Reb Chaim Meisel, who was the Yom Beitin, and probably some of the others, were frightened stiff. Who is this grandson of Reb Chaim who went to Berlin to get a PhD. You follow? Which you can understand. I'm not trying to be critical. I'm trying to be factual. They're living in a different world. Ah, who gave the Rav Smicha when he left Europe? Rav Avram Dovid, Hanna Shapiro. And it's a beautiful, beautiful letter of recommendation he gave him. I translated into English. It appears in the Rav. But the heart of the letter says, the spirit of his grandfather, Reb Chaim, rests upon him. And Reb Avram Dovber, Kahana Shapiro, could very easily handle the Rav's having a PhD. And I told you once, I don't know, this year, last year, 10 years ago, I told you, I published a monograph biography on the Kovner Rav. It appeared in Jewish Action, Jewish Life, the forerunner to Jewish Action. It's republished in Rakafet Aaron Chelek Aleph. And when I published that, a person who worked for Feldheim, I can just see his face in front of me, a survivor, but he was not a Yekka. He had learned in the Litvashi Yeshiva, and he wrote a letter to the editor. I couldn't believe my eyes. How dare you call the Kovner Rav Orthodox? He was a Maskil, he was this, he was that. Kovner Rav, the Bar Avraham. But you see, they had a problem digesting him, just as the right-wing world has a problem digesting Moreno Rabbeinu. Now, I'll tell you something else interesting. Rav Epstein, the Slobodka Rosh Yeshiva, comes with Rav Lesson, who later goes on to be the Mashgiach at YU. The Kovner Rav came, his assistant was Rav Avraham Feivelson. Anyone recognize the name Feivelson? He later remains in America, and his son, who is a fabulous personality, a machanech par excellence, a Rebbe who loved every student of his, he builds, what's the forerunner to Stern College? Teachers Institute for Women, TIW. Do you remember TIW? It's a little bit before your time, although it still functioned. I ask Dana if it still functioned when she was in Stern College. A very interesting question. It later is totally absorbed by Stern College. But he built, follow me, there's a double connection to YU from both the Kovner Rav and the Slobodka Rosh Yeshiva. Now, in relation to Rav Kook, who accompanied him, I'll tell you an interesting story. Some of you may remember that when I was a junior in college, YU announced a contest for a student who would do research on Jewish history, and they offered a $50 bond. This is 1957, 58 money, like a $50 bond is $1,000 today. So I did my research, because I loved the Mashgiach, and I did my research. This is the first article I ever published, was the 1924 visit, and I could not uncover who accompanied Rav Kook. And I write in the original article, Rabbi Kook too was accompanied by a rabbinic escort. The name of the latter is not recorded. So when I got to Israel, I was teaching in Michlala, it must be 71, 72. I mentioned this, and one of the girls said she'll check with her father, who was a very close Talmud of Rav Kook. And I got the name, Rabbi Yisrael Shimon Rabinovitz Ta'omim. He was the son of the Aderet. If you know what I'm talking about, Rabbi Eliyahu, David Rabinowitz Ta'omim, the Aderet, he was the Rav of Panovich, I believe it was Rav of Mir, and he came in Aliyah. Rav Kook was his son-in-law. Later, Rav Kook's wife died, and he married his second wife also, I think it was a first cousin to his, I think it was the daughter of the brother of the Aderet. So Rav Kook was basically accompanied by his brother-in-law. That's what it amounts to. A son of the Aderet was basically a brother-in-law. So this was the person that accompanied Rav Kook. If I can make it a little bit more meaningful, you've heard of the name Rav Mordechai Pinchas Teitz of Elizabeth. He was from the family of the Aderet. They were cousins. So this was quite a rabbinic family, and they're the ones that come to America. Now, March 18th, 1924, the Olympic, SS Olympic docks at Battery Park, and on board were Rav Kook and Rav Shapiro. Greeting them was Rav Epstein. You follow? And now thousands of people came out, big publicity, everyone from the Agudas HaRabbanim, the Central Relief, the Rabbanim Ramaz, Rabbi Aaron Teitelbaum, the Rabbi Yisrael Rosenberg, the Americanized Rabbanim, Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein, and everyone was there. Thousands of Balabatim, Harry Fisher, Leon Kamaiki, the publisher. He was the publisher of the Yiddish daily newspaper, Shema Torah and Mitzvah, and the publicity was overwhelming. Within a few days, there was official welcome ceremony at City Hall, and Mayor John P. Hyland welcomed the rabbis and presented them with the freedom of the city. The mayor said, "I am very glad of this opportunity which permits me officially to welcome to the city distinguished Jews from the old world. In Rabbis Kook, Shapiro, and Epstein, we are privileged to greet teachers and spiritual leaders whose intellectual achievements are in themselves worthy of special recognition." Now I want to ask you a question. What big deal? Say to me, Rebbe, what are you quoting? That's a publicity release. You know, kum hantif, kum morgen, who believes this? And even if it's true, not true, what good? Ah, go one step further. Imagine how the East European immigrants felt at this moment. The hundreds of thousands of Jews living on the Lower East Side, living in Brooklyn, in Williamsburg, living in Harlem. My, for all I know, my grandparents were there. I know as a fact my mother and father were at the rally against Hitler at the Madison Square Garden. They couldn't even get in. The crowd was so big. We've spoken about that many times. Agudat Yisrael was totally opposed. This is one of the, when we speak about the Rav becoming a Zionist, becoming a Mizrachist, this is one of the reasons, the old Aguda concept, don't shake the boat in public. In retrospect, the Rav cried that he didn't support the rally and the other rabbis didn't support the rally. Talking the late 30s. So for all I know, my grandparents were there. For all you know, Vic, your grandparents were there. But you see, Stolzkeit. It's like we feel today when you see a politician or a successful businessman and he's wearing a yarmulke, an officer in the army, a high-ranking officer, a pilot with a kippah, with his tzitzit sticking out. Ah, you feel good. We've achieved. We're part of the mainstream. We're no longer greenhorns. You follow me? Grine. That was the word they used. What this did for the people. Now I'll let you in a secret, but we'll turn off the tape. We don't have to. Okay. We'll let you in a secret. Right afterwards, from the delegation, someone had to respond to the mayor. So the Kovner Rav, the Slobodka Rosh Yeshiva, I don't know how good their English was, but the chief rabbi of Palestine, besides being Rav Kook, famous from one end of the world to another, had just spent 4 years in Europe. You remember what happened in World War I? He traveled out of Palestine, out of Jaffa, where he was chief rabbi, to go to the organizational meeting that would result in Agudat Yisrael. And while he's traveling, World War I broke out. He was stranded. So for 2 years, he lived in the home of the Basel Rav, Rabbi Cohn. You all know his relatives. Arthur Cohn is a son of the Basel Rav, a grandson, I should say. The man put out movies, Gabby Cohn, the Dean of Machon Gol, the grandson. He lived there 2 years. Then a rabbinate opened in London, Machzikei Hadat. And Rav Kook spent the next 2 years in London. That's where he's called back to Palestine, not to Yafo, 1919, Chief Rabbi of Jerusalem, of Yerushalayim HaKodesh. So Rav Kook knew English. So they called upon Rav Kook to speak, but Rav Kook would not speak English. He would only speak Hebrew. You understand? It's like I have a policy when I speak in public in Israel. I speak Hebrew. It's Israel. I can't get away with it all the time. I told you I was in Zichron Yaakov at my grandson's engagement party. Get up there. They tell me English. Later, under the chuppah, I spoke in Hebrew. People said, what a mistake. The grandparents from Persia, from Iran, Mitzadakala, they're living here 40 years, but they don't know English. You should have spoken English under the chuppah. I couldn't win. There was just the Brit there. I spoke English already. I learned my lesson. So Rav Kook gets up to speak in Hebrew. No, you have another problem. The mayor, Hyland, does he know Hebrew? So Herbert S. Goldstein translated into English. Rabbi Goldstein didn't realize that Rav Kook knew English too. So I heard from bystanders decades ago that Rav Kook corrected some of the translation. He said he should have used this word or that word. You follow? It's not exactly what I said, but it's a funny story. You have to be careful when you translate. For all you know, the person speaking knows both languages. But it's very fascinating who was there and the atmosphere and what was accomplished. And you can't believe what happens. They start the fundraising, they have dinners, and they now are at the White House being greeted by President Calvin Coolidge. And here, Rabbi Kook spoke with the president about Israel, about the British government, about the problems with the white paper and all that was going on in Israel and I should say Palestine. They started traveling. They were in Montreal. They were in Chicago, Philadelphia, Detroit, Pittsburgh, Baltimore, and all the communities around New York proper. And believe it or not, they didn't raise $1 million, but they raised well over $400,000. And that amount sustained the yeshiva in Palestine, which were few, but sustained the yeshiva in Eastern Europe, and it set the standard for years to come. All the Rosh Yeshiva, ultimately, had to visit the United States to raise funds. America, the Agudas HaRabbanim, the Central Relief, America, its Jews, its pious Jews, its East European Jews, took responsibility. Shoma Achi Anochi. And Rav Kook had a good vort that's been repeated many times over. I repeat it here. Rav Kook said, in America, I uncovered a new type of Yisurim, Giliti Yisurim Chadashim, new type of suffering. He says, Chazal speak about Yisurim, and then they speak about Yisurim Salahava, right? And in America, he said, I uncovered Yisurim Shel Kavod. Wherever he went, you know, the chief rabbi, Maran, the Haredi world strives on this. I don't know, maybe I should, you know, maybe it's good, you have to give cover to people, but it's, what can I tell you? As I've told you more than once, my first shtela almost destroyed me, but it did me one mitzvah. It got rid of an ego. But Rav Kook, I understand very well. Yisurim shel kavod. That was Rav Kook's expression. Now, fine, money is money. Something else happened that affects all of us sitting in this room. You see, by the 1920s in America, sure, you have the second generation, you have my father's and mother's generation, and many are rapidly assimilating. As my brother said the other day to me, we don't have, from my mother's family, six children, grandparents, my mother's mother related to Rabbi Revel, my mother's father, my mother's father learning in Volozhin, could quote Gemaras by heart. Outside of our family, my mother, one of the six children, there is not one child alive who is Jewish today. And the few that are, they decided not to have children. My brother's in touch with everyone. He knew the computer before I even knew it existed. And because he's in medicine, I guess it was vital to him to learn. So everyone, yes, you're right, they're assimilating. But there were families already in America where, and when I say America, I mean Canada as well, where they were Rabbanisha families, a few were Balabatim, where they really cared about their children's education. What becomes YU today was the main show in town. The only show on a high level. Chaim Berlin was elementary, there was not yet a high school, Teira Vadas had some sort of high school. RJJ, some sort of high school, but nothing beyond. YU, you know what Rabbi Revel did? He was always upset, I told you this many times, that everyone left. You know, they visited from Europe to raise funds, and they looked at YU, wow, what kind of yeshiva is this? What kind of kids are these? Kids are interested in baseball. You know, so Rabbi Revel had one dream, to bring a world going to America that no one should be able to talk down at the yeshiva. And September 1st, 1922, you all know the boat docked, and a little Jew got off the boat, Rav Shlomo Palachek, the Meitzer Te'iloi, Talmud Mufak of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. And for the first time, there was a goan in America not to raise funds, not to give drushes, but to teach Shas and Poskim at Yeshiva, and ultimately what becomes Yeshiva University. Now, there's no question that the Mechita raised the level of learning. And the Mechita, it's not only the level of learning. Here, I'll quote to you from the Yiddish newspapers. I quote this in Bernard Revel, I believe. And it's an eyewitness description. That's why you have to know when you do research what you can take at face value and what you have to interpret. I remember in the Mossad, so they gave us lessons. We're going to deal in Russia, and now I'm very heavily involved. And so one of the interesting things the Mossad told me, and remember, as Russia develops, remember, we're not dealing with Chabad. Chabad community was unto itself, underground, but we're dealing with the Balei Tshuva, the Refusnikim. And in 1981, January 81, our first trip, there was no machlokes. Within the years, oh boy, was there machlokes. Remember Yitzchak or not? Believe me, and there was a group in the middle. Yeah, you have no idea what went on. So, as I say, it's going to be published in the next volume of Kafar Aaron, where I say this was a heavy, wealthy, a very healthy development. It shows that they're Jews, because if Jews are alive and kicking, that has to be machlokes. I'm ksheyorif, I don't have to go further. Pashit kisisa. So there was plenty of machlokes. Now you're bringing back information, and you want to know what the truth is. The Mossad has to make decisions. There's a lot of money involved and a lot of thinking involved. And who are you sending next? And what are you doing next? So I remember the boss told me, Aryeh Kroll, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, they told you this, they told you this. If it corresponds, you start to believe it. What doesn't correspond, forget about it. You follow? It's well said. So we have eyewitnesses of what went on with the Mechita. And here you don't have to worry. This is someone writing in 1923, 1924, without any axe to grind. It's what we call halachically, new help me out, Mesiach, Lefi Tumo, right or wrong. So here, the YU in the middle of the 20s, they held the reunion of all their rabbis. what we would call today YURA, Yeshiva University Rabbinic Association, Rabbinic Alumni. So they hold this meeting, and it's the Roaring Twenties in America, and the food spread is magnificent. And the writer from the Morgan Journal says, but it was amazing. No one was at the food. He says, whoever heard of yeshiva boys not touching the food? We go to Kiddush, they make a Kiddush. I am always overwhelmed at 11 o'clock. They're eating chalent and shmalent and this and that. At 12:30, they're eating again. Sudat Shlomo HaMelech B'Shaito. I can't do it. All I do after davening is have a drink and a piece of cake for Gamanu. But wow, I have a Talmud, David Goldis. In his shul, I couldn't believe the Kiddush after the first minyan. Who can eat again? That Shabbos finished. So he says, where are all the yeshiva boys? Gathered around an old man who's speaking on a sugya in Yevamot. 1 hour and a quarter. Only when the meishit finished speaking did the boys remember there was food. So it shows you what's happening. And the meishit again, Charlie, the Meitzita was not like some of the Rabbanim you grew up with, went more right and more right. He was very broad. He knew science, he knew mathematics, he was a Zionist, he taught in Lida for Rabbi Reines. That's why he was willing to leave Europe. When the Midrash Yeshiva, Rabbi Eliezer Finkel, Rabbi Lazy Yehuda Finkel said to the Meitzita, and the Meitzita, he said to him, Shlemala, why did you leave Europe? You'd be the biggest Rosh Yeshiva today. So the Meshitar answered, it wouldn't help me anyway, because with my hashkafas, I would still have to be in America. So I want to just tell you another little tidbit about the Meshitar. It was a, I write this, his son-in-law wrote this up. It's magnificent. I mean, the depth of this. It's a simple story. He came to the yeshiva, East Broadway. He lived in Williamsburg. He now comes with the train across the bridge. We're in East Broadway, and students were always with him who were going to the yeshiva and took care of him and see that he got off at the right stop, because he was alamol fatrach. He was always thinking. So the Meitzita, it's a beautiful spring day after a bitter New York winter, and it's 8:30, yeshiva begins at 9. 70, 80 kids are playing ball in front of the yeshiva, and the Meitzita stops and he says to the children around him, including someone I yet knew, he says, why didn't we play in our youth? Was hab mir nicht gespielt in unserer Jugend? If we did it, we would have been the same goyim today, and we would have had a beautiful youth. Think about that. But that was the Meitzita. They tell a story that he saw the kids were all excited, the 1920s, this is baseball, Babe Ruth, New York, okay. And the Meshita, they say, Rebbe, you gotta know baseball. And the Meshita says, what are you looking at? And they show him a box score. And the Meshita looks at it for 2 minutes, the box score, and he gives it back. And they say to the Meitzita, nu, was hat the Rosh Yeshiva verstanden? What did you understand? And he gives them back the whole box score by heart. Every name, they were up there these many times. Had it, it was the Meitzita, Goynisha Cup. Yes, Yitzchak.
Why was he called the Meitzita?
That's a read. I did a read Rakafadara, and I have a monograph on him. Reed Revel, that's the city that he came from. You were called after the city, the Radni Eloi, the Mira Eloi. He was the Meitzita Eloi. They brought him to Reloshin. He was 12 years old. So the Netziv was very upset and said, "This is nicht a yeshiva for kleine Kinder da. It's not a yeshiva for little kids." So the father pleaded with the Netziv, "Give him a bechina." So the Netziv said to his son, to his grandson-in-law, Reb Chaim, Nem the kind and get them up again and throw them out afterwards. So Reb Chaim, it's a true story. I heard it from the Rav, but I researched it. It's true. So Reb Chaim says to the kid, what do you know? The kid says nothing. So Rav Chaim says, well, look, I'm giving you shiur today on this Gemara. Prepare and tell me what you find in this Gemara, the Rishonim. We'll talk in learning. Rav Chaim comes back 2 hours later, and the kid starts asking the exact questions that Rav Chaim was ready to ask in the shiur, and Rav Chaim and his answers were better than Rav Chaim. That's what Rav Chaim said. So he became, his bar mitzvah was celebrated in Voloshin. And this was the major, by the way, it's an amazing thing. You have gedolim from that era. Some of them, there's nothing left. Hitler wiped them out. The assimilation wiped them out. Gatz alap hitten. The major tach, living in Israel alone. I once was santek at a brit of a Talmud of mine who was married to the major's great-great-granddaughter. There were 50 little Schleimelers running around making noise. Rehovot, you know the family there. And all over. Mirsky, they're in. And there's a street named after the Mechita right next to Mekas HaRav. Rehov HaIlui Al Shem Reb Shlomo Palachek. So you see, America now, you had young people, not many, we have to be honest. Not the mainstream, but you had a group of young people who were anxious, looking, searching for Torah. You know what I've said so many times? We all have souls. The challenge to a Rebbe, a Melamed, is to find the soul of the student. Not everyone can be a Gaon, not everyone can be a genius, not everyone can be a Tzaddik. You have to, unfortunately, I realize this. I refuse to realize it, but in the last few years, if I wouldn't accept this concept, I would be so upset, so aggravated. You see people, sins, what goes on. Not everyone can be a Tzaddik, but you have to find the soul. Do you know what an impression it left on this youth, the Kovna Rav? The Levush Mordechai. Think for a minute. Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk, who is called the Malach many times over. My dear students, following the Central Relief rabbinical visit, a new pattern develops that no one could have foreseen. The best of America heads to Europe, heads to Palestine, to study with the greatest Rashi Yeshiva of the generation. You all know, a few years later, Chevron opens, branch of the Slabatka Yeshiva. Perhaps a quarter of Chevron were American and Canadians. The terrible massacres of 29, what was it, 67 dead, if I recall? 6, 7 were Americans. 2 graduates of Yeshiva University. Benjamin Horowitz. That was, you know Larry Waxman? It's his uncle. His mother's brother. Graduate of MTA. Rabbi Zev Berman. Morris Berman, remember there was a famous rabbi, Morris Berman, in the Bronx Concourse Jewish Center. His older brother was a musmach of the yeshiva, killed in Chevron. Mir tells Slabatka, 10% of the student body, 15%. It was not just good for the Americans, it was fabulous for the Eastern Europeans. Can anyone tell me why? They tutored. They had to have tutors. An American kid, as much as you knew, how do you compare with someone in Mir and Slabatka who's been learning Shas and Paiskim since the age of 6? So they needed tutors. These are facts. When I deal with the European yeshivas, Be'ez Rat Hashem, I'll show you facts, documents. They were the happiest people alive. They had whom to tutor. Rav Volk told us more than once, Rav Shmuel Ezer Volk tells you. He's a genius. Chavruta with the Rosh Yeshiva's son. Rabbi Israel Rabinovich, Rabbi Chaim, Rabbi, I told you one time in class, he's quoting Rabbi Chaim, and he look, I'm sitting right in front of him. And he says to me, Nu, Rakov, was meinach Rabbi Chaim? I say, Rabbi Chaim Briska. It's like I mentioned, Confucius. The world came to him. Rabbi Chaim Rabinovich. Oh, then I had to do research, who they were, what was the difference. But he told us more than once. He supported himself with the Germans, not the Americans, but the German kids. Tells had a lot of German kids, more than less Americans. Of course, Tells in World War I, the Germans conquered Tells, and the chaplains, Rabbi Rosenach, Rabbi Kalbach, they helped the yeshiva expand. They were very good. They were rabbanim, tzaddikim, with influence. This was World War I. It was a different Germany. And they had a kesher to Tells. Tells was organized. Tells was, compared to Tells today, Tells was a reform school. They had, could you imagine a high school? They had classes, gradations, a beis medrash, a Stern College for women, Yavne. A different ballpark. Rav Volk used to go crazy when you mentioned Tells and Cleveland. Das ist nicht Tells. Das ist nicht der Tells, was ich hab gekannt. Whoa, he ranted. It's a different world. Oh, what? And you can give the names one by one. Vogelent, his children wound up. The whole Chafetz Chaim crowd. I remember the principal of Solanta, Rabbi Leonard Pearl, as a Edel Mensch. He learned in Mir. He yet store. He learned with. He yet saw Rabbi Yeruchim Levavitz. There was Rabbi Zimmerman. Those of you know Rabbi Hecht. The name Rabbi Hecht. Do you remember his father-in-law, Rabbi Zimmerman? American-born kids. He learned in Mir many years. You can go one by one. Rabbi Bender, books have been written. The Bender family, Machanchim, they learned, who didn't go to Mir? Who didn't go to Slabodka? Tells, it was Israel, Hebron, Merkaz Harav, which was small. Merkaz Harav really didn't take off until after 67. It's interesting. Merkaz Harav, when did Merkaz Harav take off? Was, those of you who recall, Yom HaTzmut 67, which is before the Six-Day War, so Rav Tzvi Yehuda at the Suda that night, we started to cry, Omrim lanu sheyesh lanu Eretz Yisrael, yesh lanu Eretz Yisrael, eifo Hebron, eifo Shechem, ze gam ken chelek shel Eretz Yisrael, and he broke down and cried. And who could dream, a few weeks later, Eretz Yisrael is in our hands, and with all our problems, Baruch Hashem, we go mechayil el chayil. With all our problems, if you're listening to the news, it takes, I got to ask my daughter to explain to me everything that's going on. The country is shaking. There's never been a time like this, I don't recall, in all the 49 years I'm living here, where the legal system is shaking. The pillars of justice in Israel are cracking before our eyes. A judge is being removed. They made a deal with the judge. The lawyer spoke with the judge. They're freeing all the people today who they arrest. I just heard the news at 9 o'clock. I can't understand it all. To me, it's harder than working out a machlokes, a Rambam, and a Ravid, and all the Rishonim and Achronim that come afterwards. But Baruch Hashem, we're alive and kicking. So you see, this visit to America had tremendous impact on the subsequent growth of Torah. It paved the way. These people came back, ran for their lives, came back, but every institution, the length and breadth of America, benefited as a result of the rabbinical visit to the United States. Rav Gedalia Shua, that's the classic example. The Torah Vidas Rosh Yeshiva. Rav Aaron Cutler didn't want him to go back in 39. Right or wrong, wait till you see the book that I just gave Haskama to is coming out with all the documents. Okay, the world is going to shake. Let it shake. Let the research be done. But Rav Gedalia Shor knew. How many of you learned in Torah Vadas? How many of you know the name Rav Gedalia Shor? And he was in Kletsk. Kletsk already had Americans. And he's leaving, he's married, his father is furious, you got to get out, the American consul, get out, every American. And Rabban Cutler writes that letter to him while he had sold he gave up his apartment, he sold his furniture, and Rabban said, nothing will happen, it's going to be a good year, you must come back, you're first starting to steig in learning, and I'll get you a new apartment, I'll pay the rent. And of course, had he listened to Rabban, I don't have to go further. And you should know, the family kept the letter. It was a low-key secret. But what happened was, when the big machlokes began in the 80s here with Rav Shach, and he took on the Hasidic world, he revitalized and relit the controversy of the Vilna Gaon and the Baal Shem Tov and the Baal Tanya, etc., etc. So then the Agudat Yisrael, the Hasidic element of Agudat Yisrael, which is called Agudat Yisrael until today, not Degel HaTorah, so they published the letter of Rav Cutler. It was you follow me? It already got involved in the controversy. So that's when I had heard rumors about that letter, but that was the first time I ever saw it. And now in the new volume, it's quoted in detail with all the sources and footnotes, etc., etc. But wow, we benefited. Now,
doesn't this prove that Das Torah is a bankrupt ideology?
I don't know what Das Torah means. The concept of Das Torah is used by Agudat Yisrael doesn't exist in our world, in our Torah world. The Gemara uses Das Torah once in Chulin Daf Tzadeh, I believe it is. And there, what it means is tradition. It's relating to the Giran Asher, what part is Asher. But all this means, and what you're saying is, if you'll ask the question in the Beis Yaakov, they'll slap the girl's face. But they asked the question of Chatzkul Levenstein. He was Mashkiach in Mir, Mashkiach in Shanghai, and then he was Mashkiach in Panovich. And they asked Rav Chatzkul Levenstein this exact question, and this was a different world, and they were more open. And it was written up in the Beis Yaakov journal called Beis Yaakov, published in Tel Aviv in the early 60s. And Rav Chatzkul answered, a Rav when asked, what are I schlepping there? Okay, thanks. When a Rav is asked a question, he can only answer with the seichel of Torah as he understands it. And that answer should be correct. But if God wills otherwise, you cannot be correct. And I add one word, hestapanim. This is what hestapanim is all about. Hestapanim is not just the balabatim had hestapanim. The greatest rabbanim had hestapanim. And you know, until today, there are families that will not forgive the Hasidic Rebbeim who told their followers to stay behind, that I was cut off twice in 59 years of public teaching, preaching, yelling, shouting, commandoving. I was cut off twice with someone yelling out, Yimach Shmo v'zichro. That's when I quoted the Satmarov. Twice it happened. So each time I went over to the person after class, he apologized. You don't have to apologize. I'll tell you your story. I said, you're the only one left alive from your family because your father did not listen to the Satmarov to stay behind. He said, Rebbe, you're a genius. How did you know that? I said, how do I know it? The common sense, Torah common sense. I mean, history common sense. But never. You all know the story. It was the headlines in the Israeli newspapers, the mid-50s. If I'll answer you properly already, the Satmaruv, when he survived, who saved his life? The Jewish agency, the Kastner train, which itself is endless discussion. I've discussed it over the decades. So the Kastner train, Rudolf Kastner, saved about 1,500 people. Who do you choose for the train? So he chose, and later he explained it, because he was put on trial in Israel. It was a terrible story. Later he explained, it becomes known as the Noah Ark Theory. You know what I'm talking about? What did the Noah do? What was the the ark, the Noah ark. I'm looking for the word ark. There it is. The Noah ark theory. So what did he do with the ark? The Ribbono Shel told him, take two of every species, seven of the clean animals, two of everyone else. So his idea was to take two of every species of Jews. So when Judaism would be rebuilt after the Holocaust, you could rebuild it resembling what was before. So we took this type of Zionist, that type of Zionist, anti-Zionist, Shomer Tzionik, Mizrachist, and from Satmar, etc. So he saved the Satmar Rav's life. So the Satmar Rav winds up in Switzerland. From Switzerland, he goes to Eretz Yisrael. He didn't succeed here. The Yishuv HaYashan was alive and kicking, didn't need him, had no Hasidim here, no survivors here, so he left for America. And his leaving for America and everything, you know, came there, a handful of people, they came into Williamsburg, they passed the Hechsherim, they had to have it their way, there are endless stories. There's memoir literature, I can tell you some of the memoir literature I've read. So, but within a few years, he succeeded, he rebuilt his kahila, now he has money. So it has to be about 1954, 55, he visits Israel for the first time. Now, since he left in 46, when he went, really, there was no Israel yet, it was just in a state of flux, transfusion, transformation, the color, the survivors coming in, and the war about to break out. Now he visits Israel.
Why did he come?
To visit, to see what's going on here. See if he has Chsiad Chsidim here too. They're now Hungarians, revitalized. And the police chief of Kiryat HaYovel, right, that section of Jerusalem, was from a Satmar family. So the Satmar Rav is here, and the police chief of Kiryat HaYovel went to see him. And the Rebbe says to him, Rosvet Ayat Fati Gezakt, wenn zet ein gleich wie du steist von mir an a jamulka an a bod an payes. What would your father say? You're standing in front of me without a beard, without payes. That's what became of you? And the police chief answered him, Rebbe, if my father had not listened to you, he'd be standing here with me and it would be a totally different picture. And the Satmar Rav answered, knowing that until today I can't explain the answer, says, Mihamasach tshuva gitan fatafa. We've already done a lot of tshuva for what happened. Well, what does that mean? This made headlines, the Israelis newscast. Then it was a different generation. It was the survivors, the East Europeans, the Yiddish speakers. They jumped on it like gold. Everyone was talking about it. It reached America. So, all right, this is the reality, this is the story, this is Europe, this is the connection, these are the American boys. Oh, what a feeling, what a feeling. Godlet and Torah, it pulls at your heart. You want to be part of that world. Now, let me tell one story from this trip that greatly, greatly influenced my life. I heard it from the Mashgiach many times. I've mentioned it before in class, but now I want to put it into context. While they were here, so they were housed on the east side. And they were in a hotel, then they were given a home, actually, of a very wealthy member of the Schiff family. They were treated with kid gloves, as Rav Kook said, Yisurim Shel Kavod. And they come out of the hotel Shabbos morning on the east side and they take a look. Jews are selling from push carts. Could you imagine? Shabbos morning. And they shake and they shiver and they cry. And they can barely walk on to shul. But they have to. A week later, they come out of the hotel. The same Jews are there with the push carts. But they shake and shiver. They don't cry. They walk on. The third week, the scene repeats itself. Only this time, they just shake and they walk on. And the Larush Mordechai Slabotka, Musa Yeshiva, turns to everyone, the whole group around him. And he says, Moraiva Rabotai, Minzain alle Kandidaten Fachilus Shabbos. We're all candidates to be Machalus Shabbos. If we can get used to this sight, we too can become Machalalei Shabbos. The first time we yelled, we shouted, we cried, we screamed. Today we're walking by Maisim B'chol Yom, taking it for granted. Wow. This repeats itself in Shanghai. What happened in Shanghai? The Mir Yeshiva was there. So you had two people who guided them. Who does your father have smicha from? Reb Chaim Shmulevitch. Reb Chaim Shmulevitch was the Rosh Yeshiva. He was the Gaon, he was a Gaon Adir. Very broad, by the way, different than some of the other Rosh Yeshiva at that time, or in the later time afterwards. Rav Chatzkel Levenstein was the Mashgiach. He already was Mashgiach Emir, he succeeded Rav Yeruchim Levavitz. They called him back, he had been there before, and now they called him back. Well, this Shanghai story begins, first they're in Kobe, they're in good facilities, then they're in Shanghai, and then ultimately they have to move into what's like a ghetto. They're forced into it. To the credit of the Japanese, they never killed Jews. The Germans were putting pressure on them, but they refused to go along. That's the famous story with the Amshin of a Rebbe, when this... the head of the German, one of the people from the government, asked him, why do the Nazis hate you? And the Amshin of a Rebbe said, because we look different. We're Oriental. We have different blood. And after they finish hating us, they're going to hate you because you too look different. And that made a big impression. It's the Amshin of a Rebbe. The Litvisher Rebbe Moshe Schatzkes didn't know what to answer. The Amshin of a Rebbe gave that answer. The Amshin of a gave that answer. So in the ghetto, there was real privation and starvation. That's in the book. You saw with your own eyes when I showed you. Mir managed because they were getting support from America, from the Bar Hatzalah. But when they came out to go to the shul where they learned in, the Bet Aaron shul, when they came out of where they were living and had to walk a few blocks, there were dead Chinamen on the street. And Rabbi Chatzkel of Levenstein got up and gave a shmuis, you are a bunch of murderers. And the Talmidim jumped, what do you mean we're murderers? And he said, the first time you walked on the street and you saw three dead bodies of people who died of starvation, what happened? You wanted to puke. You were shaking, you were shivering. You couldn't believe it. You were crying. The second time you saw the bodies, you shook, but you walked on. The third time you saw the bodies, you jumped over them and just continued. You can become a murderer, you can become a killer. And when I heard that from the Shanghai survivors, and then I heard from the Mashgiach, because I heard the Shanghai story before I heard from the Mashgiach. Wow. Hainu hach. It's absolutely so, absolutely true. Absolutely do we need Musa? Do we have to have sensitivity? Because unfortunately, a human being can become used to anything. It's an amazing thing. It's a very good quality in a human being. A woman even more than a man, by the way. The Gemara says in Sanhedrin, kasha tiltala de gavra, more than itita, more than a woman. But it's amazing how we can adjust. But chas v'chalila, we should adjust to Chilul Shabbos or adjust to bodies on the street. And I can tell you, halacha l'maisa, this is a tremendous problem for Jews like us who live in a Torah world and a Western world, and we bridge the two. We have people in our camp who aren't even troubled. They walk on the streets on Shabbos. When a car starts, when the ignition begins, I hear it, it hurts me. Other people walk by, have a totally different approach. Democracy, freedom of choice. You are a Shomer Shabbos. He's a Mechalel Shabbos. Let it be. Wow. No, that's not so. Kol Yisrael Areivim Ze LeZeh. We're one people, one brotherhood, one community, one interconnection. If he's a Mechalel Shabbos and I get used to it, I have a share in his Chilul Shabbos. I don't say yell at him, shout at him, it won't help. But at least walk by and have tears in your eyes. That's the famous story with the Amshanava. This very Rebbe that we spoke about in Europe. So he winds up in America afterwards, then he winds up in Israel. The Amshanava family comes in Aliyah, living in Beit Vagan until today. It's a true story. I heard it from eyewitnesses 49 years ago. So one time on Shabbos, Amshanava davening by, that was a smaller Israel, very few cars, and a car comes on Shabbos, driving into Yerushalayim, in Bayit Vagan. They needed directions, seemed to be wealthy people, what we would call people from Tel Aviv, North Tel Aviv, and believe it or not, they stopped the Amshanava Rebbe, and they asked him, in Yiddish. All this took place in Yiddish. Tel Aviv was filled with Yiddish speakers, native Yiddish. You see from the classic movies here, cult movies, Shtickel Pornography, Eskimo Limon. If you ever saw those cult movies, a good part of it, the Yiddish people playing cards in Tel Aviv. It's unbelievable. So they asked the Amshanava Rebbe for directions. And the Amshanava Rebbe starts to cry. Was meint man? And he says that Jews should be Mechalel Shabbos? Crying. They get out of the car. There were survivors. They left the car. They were worried someone would harm the car. There were, you don't know what it was like having a car in the 50s when it was one and far between. He said, no, my Hasidim will watch the car. And these people became shown to return to their roots. Became big supporters of the Amshanava. This is a challenge. I'll end it off with one true story I saw with my own eyes, which I've told you many times. It came to the fore again. I told it again. We spoke about it Shabbos. I make a point of getting Yediot on Friday. Why do I get Yediot? My grandchildren used to yell at me when they were younger. Why are you wasting your money on such Nourishkeit. But I told him, I want to know what's going on in the country. It's important to see the columnists, what they're thinking. I live here. I play a role here. It's my life. So I get the Yediot. I don't read the Post because I always felt the Post is not real Israel. Yediot, Maariv, I read also. I get after Shabbos, Makor Rishon, my daughter gives it to me. Oh, I know what's going on. Yisrael Hayom, but Yediot is the biggest selling newspaper, unfortunately, but that's the reality. So I see a big ad, Roni Bodetsky died. No, who saw the ad in Yediot? Did it mean anything to you? Roni Bodetsky was one of the first settlers, the original families in Rav Berlin 18. He was a judge, married to a great-granddaughter of Rav Yeshua Leib Diskin, the Briska Rav, afterwards the Rav of Yerushalayim, Baruch Atah Adonai Melech Haolam Shehakol Nehyeh Bedvarav. They were so far from Yiddishkeit, you can't imagine. He was a judge. Mamish enmity. I used to fight with him with the Shabbos elevator. My building had a Shabbos elevator by contract, but he would carry it so he couldn't oppose it. You knew when you were buying in there would be a Shabbos elevator. But the hours, oh, don't ask. I will never let anyone say a bad word about Chabad, because this was the great-granddaughter of the Brisker Rav, as distant from Yiddishkeit as I am now from the moon. And one time I was Shkalin residence at the most famous shul in outside of Israel in the entire world, known as KJ Kehilat Jeshurun. And during the Kiddush, Rabbi Lukstein says a couple would want to meet you. This is a prominent doctor. I say, fine. He brings them over. And they say, Rabbi Rothkopf, we think you know our sister, this lady's sister. What's her name? Kolya Badetsky. I look at her. I probably fainted. They woke me up. I said, that is your sister. Here, show me Shabbos people, kids in Ramaz. And she says, I know your question, but the answer is simple. Chabad picked us up on college campus. Don't say a bad word about Chabad. The story is very important now, because this is the challenge. In 18 Berlin, for many years, we had the privilege. There are two apartments that are a hegdish. Does anyone know what a hegdish means? They were contributed to charity. One of the apartments, from the day the building opened in 69, was contributed to Yeshiva Chevron. Why? The man who built it on the west side, who made a lot of money but never married, built the apartment, sent over furniture. 69, there was no beautiful furniture in Israel. Today you have everything here. You can send from here to America, not vice versa. And he died. And in his will, he left it to Yeshiva Chevron. So over the years, they rented out. One of the long-term rentals was the Chevron Rosh Yeshivas Mechutin, Rabbi Yaleib Grishnis, the Av Beitin of London, the Leib Aryeh. If you've studied Reb Moshe's Tshuva, there's no one that gets more titles of covered than when he corresponds with Rabbi Yaleib Grishnis. So it was my privilege to know him and speak and learn with him for a good 10 years. A Gaon Adir, a Lithuanian Gadol who became an English gentleman. Av Beitin of London, beautiful English. They say his wife wrote books, detective novels under a different name, so they shouldn't identify it's the Rebbetzin. Very capable, erudite people. So I'm an eyewitness to this. All of you know I've davened 49. I haven't davened Shabbos morning in 49 years. Baruch Hashem, I davened 6:30, and if the chazan's not finished by 8, they shoot him. Go with Rivka, they don't just knock him out; they shoot him and walk out finished. So I've been able, Charlie. Third time around Shas. You don't know what it's like when you get home at 8, make Kiddush, and you learn, no telephone, no one can bother my wife, and they all go to shul then, and I'm Shas, Paiskim, Rambam. Okay. So I guess I went down to wait to greet my wife coming back from shul, my daughters, and no one was married yet, and there's Rabbi Yaleib Grishnis coming back from shul. And there are the two Bodesky children in front of the house writing with chalk on Shabbos. And Rabbi Yaleib, with his poor Hebrew, with the heavy Anglo accent, says to these kids, with his heart broken, Yiladim, Shabbat Hayom, Asur Lishtamesh Lichtov Begir. And these kids look up at this distinguished Gaon and say to him, Lo, lonu ze mutar, anachnu chiloniyim. Do you catch that answer? Torah is only for you. You're religious. We're secular. We can do what we want. That is the challenge. My dear friends, so what have we said today? All right, Baruch Hashem, it's a most important event. The three Rabbanim who came to America, three Gedolei Yisrael. The influence continues until today. Every last yeshiva benefited from the students who went to Europe, later came back to America, they all became Klei Kodesh. Maybe there are a few that studied in Europe that became Balabatim and went into business, but they were all became Klei Kodesh. They were edel. There was something special. There was a Rabbi Samcho. I'll give you another example. From anyone here from Brooklyn, from Flatbush, Rabbi Samcho, Kingsway Jewish Center. You knew him?
No, but the Rabbi Philip Goodman, my father-in-law, in 1932, came to Palestine to study with Rav Kook.
Right, that's your father-in-law, exactly. And Samcho studied in Mir in Europe. And he was a different person. There was a certain edelkeit to him that an American didn't have. And you can go right down the line, one after another. And Kanayin Hara, the influence they had. And this is a beautiful story. Minishamayim, funds were raised. The yeshivas were saved. Next week, Be'ezrat HaNotein Le'Yov Koach, on Sunday, with Mr. Shear for all the gold in Fort Knox. We are dealing with Romania and that second marriage and the children and the mamzeret and the get that was or was not given and the mail and what did she get in the mail. Oh, fascinating. Rav Ovadia, kol hakavod, what he has to deal with, and he deals with it and solves it. Monday, we are going to deal with a shoot-off of World War I, Ezras Teira, Reb Yosef Eliyahu Henkin. That will be the start of the heart of next Monday's Shia. And now, the freebies. This please give to Morty Tarrigan. If anyone wants to see anyone here at Talmud of Rav Schechter, beautiful picture and a very fascinating interview. And I am happy shekivanti l'dak gedolim. If anyone wants the document on the Tzion Levi's and why you and the public, it's amazing what's on the computer. I don't know. We're gaining so much. Hi, young. I hope what's her email? What's the difference? We're lost. There's a problem with the YU computer system. Nothing is reaching me. What's the difference? I'm so busy I can't answer anyone now. Okay. Gentlemen, this is an unbelievable Chilul Hashem, which you've heard about. And here, if you want the pictures, here it is. I don't know. Ne'er Yisrael has been in the news lately. Not so positive. Mishenichnas Ada Marbim Besimcha, and they did a whole series, spent time, effort, putting together a whole mockery of Chabad. It's caused a terrible outcry. You can't hide here. I'll give you a simple example. Wak a hat station. You know what this is? Chabad's hat, the Chabad hat is different than the yeshiva hat. It's knocked in a little. So here's a hammer, go knock your hat in so you look like a Chabadnik. They put up a sukkah now, come in and be no tail lulav in their throat. They're mocking Chabad and how they get after Jews to do a mitzvah. It's very, very sad. What can you do? If anyone wants to see it, living evidence, here it is. Here's a fabulous article, Do You Come?, on Chief Rabbi Lazar and his relationship with the President of the World, Mr. Putin. It's worth reading. Yomo, do you have Russian citizenship yet?
No.
You don't?
No.
Too bad. That's the only citizenship you're allowed to have outside of Israel, because it's the only place where they observe the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach. Here's an article Yomo sent me, which is unbelievable. This lady goes from being a Catholic high school girl, she's Caribbean, to Hasidic Jewish wife. No kidding, here it is, the New York Post. And I was amazed, I couldn't understand how a Satma Hasid could marry a convert. After all, the convert is second best, you know, the way the Haredim are, particularly the Hasidim. So it turns out he dies of an overdose. You understand? So we know where he's coming from.
About tshuva.
Okay. And she continues strong. Beautiful article about the Rebbe. A kid delivering food that the wife bought, and he gives the kid a tip, a $10 bill. And what it does to this kid, boy, oh boy, why didn't I have the muscle to deliver food to the Rebbe? Son of a Holocaust survivor is named the president of Harvard. Could you imagine? So you have one president, the Soloveitchik.
You have to know what it means. In 1930s,
right.
The president had set up a quota system
at Harvard. Right.
And he was
anti-Jewish. Right, and second generation. This is a very moving article from the New York Times. It's a description of all the kids and the teachers killed in Florida. And they come to life. And you know where that Gehillah is. It was the adjacent Gehillah to where I was for 2 weeks, a few weeks ago. You follow? Fort Lauderdale, Hollywood is part of Fort Lauderdale, is the adjacent Gehillah to this Gehillah. Now, I saw something unbelievable. One of the newscasts, when the kids are leaving Florida to go see the President of the United States, right? We're talking a few days ago. So the person broadcasting is standing on a car and describing the scene, how the kids are coming. Right in back of the car, the Chabad Rebbe is putting tefillin on a Jewish kid, and you can't miss it. Whoever watched that newscast saw the Rebbe's Chabadnik at work and the kid putting on tefillin, kedat v'kedin. And finally, only Russians. This is about a musmach, a Chabadnik, a Russian kid, a Baal Tshuva, who is a world champion boxer. How Yiddishkeit and boxing only maybe in Israel during the Israeli army, and perhaps we can use a few boxes. I want to thank everyone from the bottom of my heart of honoring me with your presence today. I just want to mention we should all have a happy Purim. I don't know what you're doing on Friday. Big machlokes hapeskim. I see everyone giving out. But I can only tell you one story, okay? Here it was. I'm a little kid in the Rav Shir, and Shushan Purim night, the night after Purim. One of my closest friends, who I went to school with for 18 years, Shaya Balin, is marrying in Boston. It's a big trip up to Boston. So I go to the Rav and I say, Rebbe, when can I eat my Purim Suda on Purim? We got it. Leave New York at 12 o'clock to be there for the wedding. And, you know, I didn't know how to learn that much then. What's the Shaila? He says, the Vilna Gaon ate his Purim Suda every year at 11 o'clock in the morning. That was the Rav's answer. And that was quite a wedding. Remember what I told you? We get there to the wedding, Motzei Purim, and the Rav, Masada Kedushin, Baruch Atah Hashem, Elokeinu Melech Olam, Shehakol Niyeh B'dvaro. And we couldn't believe our ears. We thought, what's going on here, Rebbe? Then we found out there was no sealed bottle of wine in the shul. And the Rebbe was choshish that the caretaker touched everything. So it's Masada Kedushin, the Kol Shel Bracha, on Chama Medina. Like, follow? And he made the Bracha Shehakol. So all I can tell you is Purim morning, I'm not my own balabas, I'm at the children, but my daughter tells me 12 sharp we're eating. I would prefer 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock. But all right, those of you who are Purish, Mapim Makadesh, that requires ability, and also you can't get drunk because you got to dab marv after the meal, you follow? So it's a lo pashut. But I prefer the Vilna Gaon system. It should be a beautiful Purim, a beautiful Shabbos. Sunday, Monday I'm teaching. And then from Monday night on, pray for me that I should have koach to fulfill all the obligations upon me, lechagdil Torah lehadira, and I hope Be'ezrat Hashem to bring kavod to my Rebbe's memory and to live up to all the nice words that why you played on me to get me to agree to come. Until we meet again in health and happiness, das v'danya. Okay.